The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, Q&A edition today. So we're going to be answering some questions. I do want to jump right in with something I keep forgetting to mention on the show that a lot of people have questions about and we've talked about in the past. That is this whole question of, will the average wage index in 2020 create some type of permanent penalty for people who were born in 1960? And if you have no idea what I'm talking about, I'm not going to rehash the whole thing. But there was last summer, so summer of 2020, there started to be this squawking on the internet and through many articles out there about how due to the pandemic and the disruption in the employment force and the wages for the country, the average wage index for 2020 was going to take a huge hit and cause, due to the way they calculate your Social Security benefit when you turn age 62, it would permanently damage those who were born in 1960 unfairly. So I have some additional information for that. This is coming from a letter from the Congressional Budget Office. Letter's actually dated January 27th, so this has been out for a little bit. I apologize for not getting it to you in the last 60 days. I looked for more up-to-date information, and there doesn't appear to be any, but this was a letter from the Congressional Budget Office to the Honorable Chuck Grassley, Chairman of the Committee on Finance in the U.S. Senate, and it was addressing this issue directly. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but the essence is the Congressional Budget Office now, back in September, had predicted a decline in the average wage index for 2020 to be 3.8%, and that was going to cause this disruption or recalculation or, I guess, damage to the calculation specifically for people who were born in 1960. Again, it's a complicated issue. I'm just going to stop with my description at that. People have questions on that. We can discuss it in greater detail in the future. But the good news is, as of the end of January, the CBO currently estimates that the average wage index for 2020 is going to only decline by 0.5%. Not 3.8. So, and that was the end of January, and most of the revised numbers for 2020 are coming in a bit better overall in most areas. So we'll see what the final number turns out to be, but it looks like, as I predicted last summer, that this was a lot of hand-wringing over something that was likely not to be as big an issue as people were making it out to be. But it created a lot of nice headlines and clickbait on the internet. But there's the official word, at least, from the CBO estimates as of the end of January. Not a huge hit to the average wage index for 2020. Sorry to steal some of your thunder on the intro, Jim. You've been sitting there quietly. Why don't you join us and share with us the first question you might have?
No, it's okay. I like you. I mean, listeners realize you tend to go down these rabbit holes and go on and on and on and on. And I let you.
Why, thank you.
I thought that was very nice of me.
Just for the record, I control the mute button, so whether you let me do it or not, it's going to happen.
You saying you would just mute me?
I would just mute you if I needed to. So
that's true. You do anyway, control everything on the podcast. All righty. Well, hi, folks. Hopefully you're enjoying whatever it is you're doing on this fine day as you're listening to another episode of the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A version. We've got many questions we're going to get to. As always, we're going to begin with Social Security questions. We just kind of started doing that a couple of years ago. We like to do it that way. And when I put out a call for Social Security questions, Chris, we got a bunch in. So we're going to get two more done today. Does that sound good?
Sounds good.
All righty. We'll go with the first one. Both of these are fairly straightforward and easy. I will begin with one from the fine state. Well, I'll let you guess, not guess, choose. We have one from the far East Coast, New York. I'm not sure if it's city or state, and Portland. So two totally different coasts. Which coast do you want to begin, the right or left coast?
Well, it's later in the day back east, so let's do New York first.
New York first. Okay. Greetings from the formerly great state of New York. So that's what he wrote, not me. Not trying to imply anything about New York, but here a resident doesn't really like it anymore. Okay. Hi, guys. I love the show. I have a question about Social Security. I created my own Social Security estimation spreadsheet because I'm an engineer, and, well, that's what we do. I loved when he wrote that, Chris.
That's what we do. Yep.
It's just, I get it. It's so typical. He's right. I mean, that's what engineers do. They see a problem, they're going to go out, write a spreadsheet, and fix it. Okay. And that's what we do. I'm 54, and based on my earnings record, I'll basically be getting a high percentage of the max payout once I collect. Mm-hmm. Could you discuss the current max payout value and how you would estimate what it may be in 2037? Is it just applying future 2037 is when he turns 70, Chris. Mm-hmm. Is it just applying future COLA adjustments, or does wage inflation impact the theoretical max payout as well? I may be a black and white numbers guy, but I also love your banter. And that's the reason yours is the only podcast I always turn to. Keep up the great work. Then he gives his real name and says again, the formerly great state of New York. We will call him George as always. So, George, I know you addressed this question, I think, in the past, but how would you recommend George adjust his Social Security spreadsheet?
Well, excellent question. Currently, there is a theoretical maximum for the, it's not theoretical, it's a mathematical maximum for the Social Security benefit at full retirement age. In 2021, the maximum Social Security benefit at full retirement age is $3,148 per month. That would be for people turning 62 in 2021. So that number changes as time goes by due to the average wage index and its application to the bend points that are used in calculating the averaged indexed monthly earnings and subsequently the PIA, primary insurance amount, for determining your full retirement age retirement benefit. So back to his first question. So I just wanted to put that out there, that if people want to know what's the maximum you can get, that's not the maximum you can receive as a benefit, by the way, because that's your full retirement age benefit. You could still earn delayed retirement credits above that. But in his spreadsheet for trying to figure out or forecast what future benefits might be, there's two things at play here that are going to affect his calculations. One, his earnings record is going to be affected by another 6 years worth of wage indexing. He said he's 54. Average wage indexing applies to your earnings record through the age of 60. Any earnings after 60 are not indexed for wage inflation. So he's got some wage inflation effects in here for the next 6 years that he's got to make a forecast to estimate And then we have, on top of that, cost of living adjustments that are going to apply after the wage indexing is ignored, essentially. So, and then he throws in delayed retirement credits, which are a whole nother thing that affects the actual benefit. But the cost of living adjustments and the average wage indexing will affect the base benefit, the PIA, the full retirement age benefit. And then other effects, either early claiming or late claiming, will reduce or increase the actual benefit paid due to the early filing penalties or the delayed retirement credit accrual up till age 70. So he's got a lot of moving parts here. So when he asks, is it COLA or wage inflation? It's both for him. Once you reach age 60, it's just cost of living adjustments that you need to be factoring into future benefit estimates. But he's still got some years of wage inflation that is going to apply to his record. So as far as how do we calculate it, we use some software. I have a spreadsheet that calculates things, but it's usually applicable to those who have turned 62 already. If people are younger than that, we usually use some software that assumes the median or intermediate assumption for wage inflation as provided by the Social Security Administration. The trustees of the Social Security system publish a document every single year. And our software uses the intermediate estimate, so the middle of the road estimate for wage inflation in its forecasting assumptions. And so we do make a prediction for what type of earnings people are expected to be making between now, say a 54-year-old, and when they're planning to retire. We will apply this forecast for wage inflation for the next 6 years. We will have an assumed cost of living adjustment in there if people want to see that, although we usually do all of our calculations in current year estimate terms, so we don't apply cost of living adjustments to the estimates that we're usually dealing with, but that's because we're reflecting the benefits that are payable in the future in current year equivalent values, in other words. But some people do it the other way. Some people actually look at all the future benefits with the cost of living assumptions built in to those assumptions. You can do it either way and have justification or an argument to be made for either way being, quote, correct or most helpful. So those are the factors at play. I think I tackled everything that he was curious about there. And could you build that all into a spreadsheet? Yes, you could. Sounds like he needs to add a few elements to his, but I stopped heading down that road of spreadsheet construction when this extremely low-cost software became available. I let them then worry about all of that, and I don't have to maintain my spreadsheet and update it all the time because the software is automatically doing it. So I've left the spreadsheet world for these calculations a while ago because of that.
Okay, well, that sounds good. Anything else you want to add?
No, I think I hit that one.
Perfect. So we will leave from the great state of New York, formerly great state of New York. And
there's other states to move to. I'll point that out to him.
Say what?
There's other states he can move to if he doesn't like that state.
Kentucky or Ohio could work. Just say it.
Those are two choices.
Two choices that yours truly may partake in. All righty. So this next one is also, we'll call them George. Actually, this would be a Georgette from Portland, Oregon. Okay. Hi, Jim and Chris. I hope you are both doing well. So far, we are. You doing okay?
So far, so good.
So far, so good. Same here. I hope Jim has recovered from his heart procedure. Well, Jim hasn't gone in for his heart procedure, so he hasn't recovered yet. I go under the knife, actually, in a couple more days, folks. So keep your fingers crossed. I go in this coming Monday. Monday, what's that? The 29th, I believe it is. 8:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And hopefully by noon. Well, actually, it won't be done by noon because everyone says I have to be at the hospital like an hour and a half, 2 hours before the operation. Mm-hmm. I think they actually start slicing and dicing at 10:15, 10:30, somewhere around there. Hmm. And hopefully I'll be done by noon, a little bit after, and woken up somewhere by 4 or 5 o'clock. I don't know how long it takes. And everything
you'll be
fine.
You'll be awake in like 20 minutes after you get out.
Oh, no kidding. They wake you up that soon? Yes. Could I put in a request for a good sleep and to just let me rest?
If you bribe the anesthesiologist, maybe they'll give you one last dose before you get rolled out.
Can you just let me sleep a little longer? All right, so whatever, folks. But I go in on Monday, all jokes aside. I do want to thank everyone who has reached out. I've had many listeners reach out who have had the procedure. I've had some physicians reach out to tell me about it. An anesthesiologist recently reached out to tell me about the anesthesia, I guess you call it, that I'm going to be getting. And I appreciate everyone who tells me not to worry. The general consensus, Chris, is the anticipation that I'm going through is worse than the actual procedure.
Yeah.
So
unless they do it to you while you're awake, and then that's horrific.
You know, some a person, I think it was a woman, I can't remember, had hers done while she was awoke.
No, thank you.
I mean, granted, they gave her something where she didn't feel it, but she was awoke. And she recommended I do it that way, that it's, quote, really cool to watch. And one of our physician clients got a hold of me, and he encouraged me to request to be awoke and to watch it because I'm going to be amazed. And I'm like, Doc, maybe for you, you're a physician. I don't want to be awoke for this at all. No, I'd freak out. I mean, I'm already freaking out. Can you imagine me awoke? Especially if he's doing his little stuff and I hear him go, uh-oh. I mean, I'll just stop panicking. It's not, no, I don't want to be awoke for that. But someone also did tell me who went in for the same procedure I'm doing. The operating room didn't look like an operating room because apparently they use a joystick and everything to get whatever it is they send up the vein into my heart. Mm-hmm. He said he thought he was looking at the console of a really cool video game.
Hmm.
So
I don't want to see anyways. Any of that. I want to be out.
Say
period.
What?
I want to be out for anything like that. I don't want to see any of that.
Oh, no, I'd panic. I know me. Yeah. There's just no way I'd be panicking. Or I'd be trying to carry on a conversation with the doctor about something. And he'd be like, will this guy please shut up so I can get going? So, no, there's no way I'm going to be awoke for it. But, again, thanks for all the well wishes, folks. I will let everyone know how I turn out. And ultimately, of course, for everybody out there with AFib, such as myself, I hope the procedure works, although I have been warned by the cardiologist, the electrophysiologist, I think is what I'm seeing. People in a consistent permanent state of AFib like myself suffer a greater chance of it not working than people who are only in it occasionally. So anyways, my fingers are crossed, everything works out, and I'll keep everyone posted. All right, enough of that. Hi, Jim and Chris. I hope you are both doing well and Jim has recovered from his heart procedure. I will keep this brief. I'm on my phone and I only text with one finger. As someone who also does that, I feel your pain, but I would suggest the voice text, which is what I do now. And I know you've had this for a while, Chris, on your little Galaxy phones there, your Android. You're an Androidian. Mm-hmm. But the new iPhone lets me type with that sliding the finger across the keyboard thing.
Mm-hmm. You like that?
Well, at first, it I didn't, but it is pretty damn cool, and it really works.
Yeah.
And I'm getting better and better since I only type with one darn finger anyways, like this man. If you have the new iPhone like I do, because I'm so tech and hippie, not hippie, hip. I've replaced my 9-year-old iPhone with a brand new one this year. And you can type just by sliding your finger across the keyboard. I don't know how it does it, but it works.
I think they've had that for a while. You just didn't have it in your 9-year-old iPhone 1 or whatever you were using.
Oh, Apple has had that for a while?
I think it's been a while, yeah. Because my wife.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought it was new. Well, it was new for me.
Everything's new for you.
Since I went 9 years before replacing my last iPhone.
The battery lasts more than 3 hours.
That it does. The battery lasts a lot longer. And anyways, so listener, if you're still texting with one finger, you may want to get the newer iPhone. Or if you already have an Android, you have this ability to text by sliding your finger across the keyboard. You should check it out. Okay. I know Chris has spoken in the past about this, but what is the difference between survivor benefits and divorced survivor benefits? Would you please repeat them? I'm particularly interested in the difference in the earnings test and the age qualification for receiving my maximum benefits. Thank you very much. We'll call her Georgette from Portland, Oregon.
Very nice. So survivor benefits can be paid to a survivor of a number holder who has earned a Social Security benefit on their own record and has a qualifying marriage. We'll not go into all the characteristics of a qualifying marriage, but for survivor benefits, you essentially have to have been married for at least 9 months and be married when the number holder passes away. And then the general rules are that the survivor can receive a benefit equal to what that number holder was either collecting or would have received had they been collecting when the person passed away. Assuming you'd reached the minimum age for survivor benefits, which is age 60 or 50 if you are disabled. So those are the basic requirements. For divorced spousal benefits, the marriage, it's all the same rules. The marriage had to have lasted at least 10 years, and they go right to the anniversary. If you miss it by a day, you miss the whole thing. So as long as you were married by your anniversary date, you're all good. Divorce, you're still eligible to receive a spousal benefit. I'm sorry, survivor benefit. We're talking about those. There are divorce spousal benefits, but a survivor benefit, if that person passes away, even though you're not still married to them, and you have to meet all the same rules as if you were actually still married to them. And believe it or not, there can be multiple survivor benefits paid on the same number holder's record because that person may have remarried. And then when they pass away, then there's an ex-spouse who had been married to them for at least 10 years and maybe a current spouse or maybe a few spouses that each were married to them 10 years that all qualify for a survivor benefit. But the surviving spouse to get the survivor benefit must be at least age 60 or age 50 if disabled. If the maximum benefit isn't received at 60, that would be an early claiming. To receive the maximum survivor benefit, you must wait till the full retirement age, which, believe it or not, for certain people, the full retirement age for retirement benefits and the full retirement age for survivor benefits is actually a slightly different date. That's a segue I'm not going to go off onto right now because it just muddies the question here, but just wanted to clarify the basic rules of collecting the survivor benefit. So the only difference between the two is that there's an extra qualification for a divorced spouse in that they have to have been married 10 years. A current spouse, when the person passes away, they've only had to have been married for 9 months to collect a survivor benefit. And that even goes away if it was an accidental death. So there's some very minimal requirements for a survivor benefit for a current spouse. A divorced spouse, 10 years is the kicker. But all the other rules, as far as the age you can claim, the amount you're going to get, all that's the same. The earnings test also applied the same. So in this case, I'm guessing this person can qualify for a survivor benefit, but is still working and is under their full retirement age. Remember, the earnings test goes away the month you turn your full retirement age. But if you are collecting a benefit while still working and under your full retirement age, so whether the benefit is survivor benefits, spousal benefits, your own retirement benefits, any Social Security benefit is subject to the earnings test if you are claiming before your full retirement age. Now, the earnings test limits vary. They go up. They change every year. The earnings test limit in 2021 is $1,580 per month or $18,960 a year. So if that survivor benefit, if you're receiving it while working and under your full retirement age, they're going to reduce that benefit $1 for every $2 over that $18,960 per year. In certain cases, you can have them apply it on a monthly basis rather than a yearly basis. Then in the year you turn your full retirement age, that limit goes way up from the $18,960 all the way up to $50,520 per year before there's an earnings test. And then even if you exceed it, it's even relaxed. It's $1 for every $3. Most people aren't affected by that one, so we don't talk about that one a lot, but that officially is the earnings test. Whether they were divorced survivor benefits or current spouse when they passed away, who now is receiving survivor benefits, the earnings test is applied the same way. So I think that answers their question. Did that hit on? I don't have the question in front of me. I have to go by what Jim reads to me. So sometimes I'm not sure I've checked all the boxes on the questions, but do you think that addressed everything that they were asking?
I think it does, Chris. The one thing that I'll throw out there to this listener, or listeners in general, if you wanted, I was surprised when I read this question. I read it a few times to make sure I was getting it correct. Normally, people want us to explain, Chris, the difference between spousal benefits and survivor benefits. This one is the difference between survivor benefits and divorced survivor benefits. I think that's the first time we've ever been asked that. It's almost like they're wondering, if I decide to get divorced, I'm not sure yet, and my this is a woman, so her spouse, whether it's male or female, it doesn't matter anymore. But it's almost like they're trying to wonder, if I get divorced and they die,
right?
What are the differences? And I'm wondering if she actually meant the difference between spousal and survivor. So if that's what you wanted to know, we're not going to get deep into that on this, in case that wasn't your question, write back to us and say, hey, you know, Chris did a great job explaining the difference between survivor benefits and divorced survivor benefits, but I was actually trying to ask the difference between spousal and survivor benefits. Mm-hmm. That confuses a lot of people, Chris, because they both begin with the letter S and they both have to do with the same number holder, as you say, but the rules are dramatically different. Because one, you're claiming when the number holder was alive, and the other, you're claiming when they are dead, and the rules are different.
Mm-hmm. And I will add, if the story is related to what you're kind of injecting in there, where they're contemplating getting divorced and wondering how it might affect their survivor benefits, as long as you've been married 10 years, whether you're divorced or not, you are going to be eligible for a survivor benefit. I will throw in there, though, that 10-year limit is a hard limit, and I have been really disappointed, saddened is probably the best word, to hear multiple times from people who got divorced after 9 years, 9.5 years, etc., and their divorce attorney never mentioned to them, let's wait to file the final paperwork on this until we hit your 10th anniversary, because it opens up a world of possible benefits for you that you will walk away from if you get divorced right here, right before you hit the finish line. So if you know someone who's contemplating divorce and they aren't not, and I'm not proposing they force themselves to stay in an abusive relationship, you can be separated, just not legally divorced. So you're not required to stay in the home, you're not required to live with them, you're not required to like them, you're not required to love them. You're just required to be legally married until your 10th anniversary, and they do not waver on that. No matter what the circumstances, no matter if you are dire in poverty afterwards because of this, they do not waver in this. You've got to get to the 10th year. So if you or someone you know is in the close to that 10-year mark, make absolutely sure they know the ramifications of this decision before they get the judge to finally stroke of pen divorce legally if it's going to happen before that 10th anniversary, because I have run into cases where they made it so close And I said, well, there's no way of undoing it. Didn't your divorce attorney talk to you about this? And they say, no, there was never a mention of it. And that is horrific. That is horrible. I think it's verging on malpractice for someone who's supposed to know the ramifications of a divorced person. But anyway, just wanted to throw that out there because I'd hate for that to happen to somebody else.
I agree. And I would also say, even if you are thinking, well, it doesn't matter for me, I'm going to claim my benefits anyways. I'm not going to claim this person's benefit. I'm just going to go get divorced. Let's say both of you were near equal in Social Security value, both spouses, Chris. So both spouses think, well, the hell with it. There's no benefit. It's not like you're going to claim mine or I'm going to claim yours. We have identical benefits or close to identical benefits. I would still wait because, gosh forbid, if one of you passes away, you then would have the ability, or am I getting wrong on this, Chris? If they were to stay, well, actually, it wouldn't matter for survivor benefits, would it? What I'm thinking is because survivor benefits are different than spousal benefits, and you could actually claim a survivor benefit without impacting your own personal benefit. Mm-hmm. But because they're survivor, you only need that 9-month rule, not the 10-year rule, correct?
No. Divorced benefits are only available if you've been married for 10 years. Whether they're survivor or spousal.
Whether they're survivor or spousal. Mm-hmm. Okay. So
the 9 month is just to open the door to survivor benefits to anyone. You've got to hit the 9 month mark, 12 months for spousal benefits. So you can't, that prevents someone from getting married on their deathbed.
Correct.
So that they can pass off a survivor benefit to someone, their favorite nurse, for instance. There's that 9 month rule. 12 months for spousal benefits. So spousal benefits don't, with some exceptions, which I won't go into right now, won't go into effect until you've been married for 12 months.
12 months.
But
mm-hmm.
to get benefits on after a divorce on the previous spouse's record, have to be married for 10 years, hitting the 10th anniversary to get credit for it.
Okay, then
what you're saying
to explain
is correct in that you'd want to do it for both. Even if both spouses are amicable and want to help each other out,
right.
Wait 10 years to pull the trigger on it, because then it opens the door to some strategies that you would have been able to take advantage of if you had stayed married. You retain those strategies as a divorced pair.
Divorced couple.
Mm-hmm. So,
exactly.
And it's not just, you know, looking out for one or the other. It can help. It can open the door to both of you in case certain things happen in the future. So there's reaching that 10-year mark before you cut things off can make a lot of sense.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was trying to say. Even if you don't think it's going to apply to you, wait that 10 years if you could, because there are, which we won't get into on this answer, definite strategies to do so.
Right.
Okay. Yep. I think you covered that. And again, listener, if you actually meant the difference between spousal and survivor, write back to us and I'll have Chris answer that. All righty. So now we are going to go to the fine state of Virginia. So we got a George from Virginia who clearly points out he is a Packers fan, even though he lives in Virginia.
That's respectable.
Yep. Okay. So he begins, hello, guys. This is George from Virginia. I'm kind of a new listener, only spending 4 months listening. I found you through the, well, I won't say where he found us from. I don't want to sound like we're endorsing something, where you guys will find lots of fans of your show. I understand you, well, actually, I won't keep reading this because he's talking about a group that he belongs to, and I don't want to sound like we're pushing something like that. Okay, so let's get to the question. Hopefully I can ask this question in a way that's going to make sense to you. My wife and I have been doing Roth IRA contributions for more than 5 years. Now that's important, folks. And Chris, as you know, if your Roth is more than 5 years old, when you start taking distributions, that's going to be a very important metric. So he makes it perfectly clear in his question, Chris. They've been contributing for more than 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In 2022, So next year, my wife will be 57, at which point she is going to retire. We would like to begin doing conversions of her rollover IRA to a Roth IRA. Mm-hmm. I'll pause there, folks. What I think he's saying is when she retires, she's going to take her employer 401k and transfer to a IRA and begin converting it mm-hmm. to a Roth IRA. That's my interpretation of
like
what
it.
He's saying.
Yep.
So anyways, I just want to point that part out. We are doing these to fill up our joint 12% bracket and help lower our required minimum distributions in the future. Mm-hmm. So they makes perfect sense. They're trying to do some tax planning during what we call their tax planning window. Mm-hmm. He does indicate also what they're trying to do is lower any future widow-widower tax penalty that they might be exposed to. And the best way to do that, listeners, is to get some of the money in an IRA into a Roth IRA to lower the required minimum distributions of the survivor. Because remember, surviving spouses will be filing taxes as a single tax filer, which right now have brackets that are just about half the size of the brackets of a married tax filer. So we call that the widow-widower tax penalty. Through no fault of their own, they're all of a sudden paying more taxes in raw dollars because of them all of a sudden have to file as a single person. I will be 59 and a half, he continues. I will be 59 and a half, and I would like to direct all of my earnings in my Roth IRA out of the Roth IRA and into our spending account. And we will use this money to help pay taxes on the conversion. Mm-hmm. So what they're saying and what I'm gathering, Chris, is they don't have enough money outside of their always taxable retirement accounts to pay the taxes on the conversions.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If they were to pay the taxes from the money being converted, there would be less money, I guess, in the Roth IRA, obviously, in their mind. So he's saying, why don't we take some of the earnings out of our Roth or his Roth and use those earnings to pay the taxes or help pay some of the taxes on the conversions. Does that make sense
so far? Well, let me add to that, because the reason I'm pretty sure he's doing that, talking about taking it from his, is that she's only 57, so she'll have the 10% penalty if she tries to pay the taxes from the IRA rollover itself. So they're avoiding that by taking it from his Roth instead, because he's reached 59 and a half. Now, she has a Roth, and there's some argument that there's some stuff you do there. We're going to get into order of distributions from the Roth, I'm sure. I know where this is headed from the description. But I just wanted to point out it's most likely all about the 10% penalty avoidance for taking distributions that are unqualified for the wife trying to do these conversions. So they're using his.
I would say that's the case. So let's talk about that now, because he continues in the paragraph below this. When the spouse, the female who's 57, when she turns 59 and a half, they're going to start taking earnings out of her Roth as well to continue to pay taxes. So they were trying to avoid the 10% early withdrawal penalty that she or they thought she would be exposed to because she's only 57. He's over 59 and a half. Mm-hmm. She's just 57. The one thing I want to say that Chris alluded to, but I will expand upon, listeners and listener with the question, the first distributions out of a Roth IRA are always contributions.
Emphasize always.
Yes, always. I said always.
I'm doing dramatic effect for people that the emphasis is on always. The way he's talking, it's almost like he believes he can cherry pick earnings and take them out. Not how it happens.
No. And even in his case, and that's what I was going to mm-hmm. get to. So the first dollars out of an Roth IRA are always contributions. Always, always, always. Then conversions, then growth. He's worried about the 10% early withdrawal penalty that his wife would be faced with because she is under the age of 59 and a half. She's right. Only 57. So he's going to debit some money from his Roth to help pay taxes. He doesn't say if he's going to cover all the taxes or some. He just says he's going to debit some of the earnings or direct some of the earnings.
But he probably doesn't need to do that.
In his mind, folks, he's taking earnings.
Right.
In the eyes of the IRS, he's taking contributions.
Right.
That's what I need him to understand and all listeners to understand. So the money could come from your wife's Roth, listener. Mm-hmm. You said you've had a Roth for more than 5 years. You don't say how many years. Has it been 10, 15, 20, 7, or 8? You just said more than 5. You also don't say how much you were putting in a Roth, but since both of you were funding a Roth, I'm going to guess you maxed out the contributions. So even if you only had it for exactly 5 years or 6 years or whatever, but you still probably have 30, 37, 40, 45,000 of contributions minimum inside those Roths. Mm-hmm. That's the first dollars out.
Right.
You may say, hey, my Roth earned $3,000, so I'm going to take $3,000 out. In your mind, you're taking the earnings. In the IRS's mind, you took contributions. In fact, you have to track it on Form 8606. You never indicated anywhere to the IRS you put money into a Roth. You don't list Roth contributions on your 1040 like you do IRA contributions. The IRS knows you have a Roth because they get form, I can never remember form numbers. I think it's 5498. They get form 50, Google that, make sure I'm correct. 5498 from the IRA custodian every year indicating your Roth value. So the IRS knows you have one, but you will track when you start taking money out of an IRA on Form 8606, Roth IRA, excuse me, on Form 8606, you are going to keep track. That's where you start declaring your contributions. That's when the IRS starts measuring it. And you are going to track every distribution on 8606, and you are going to indicate how much contributions are in there, how much you took out, and how much are left. Contributions are static. The dollar amounts are static. They don't rise or fall in the eyes of the IRS. So if you've got a $100,000 IRA and you got $50,000 of contributions we talked about in the past, that $50,000 is static. It only gets reduced by your initial withdrawals, and that's what you use 8606 for. So the money can come out of your wife's Roth. It could come out of your Roth. It does not matter that she's under 59 and a half. Contributions come out first. Because she's only a couple of years, 2.5 years from hitting 59 and a half, and you've had this Roth for more than 5 years, I doubt you're going to remove more than the contributions in your strategy. Once your wife is also over 59 and a half, she can start taking money out, including growth, without paying taxes on it. And the other 10% penalty, if you were to remove conversions, and remember, the first dollars out are always contributions. If you got through all the contributions, the next dollars before earnings are going to be conversions. But once both of you, or once she, you are already over 59 and a half, once she is over 59 and a half, the 10% early withdrawal penalty on conversions also goes away.
Right.
So once you're over 59 and a half, don't worry about the 10% penalty on withdrawing conversions within 5 years of the conversion. That goes away as well. So I think they're going to be able to do what they're doing, but I think they could take it from the wife's Roth without a problem. They don't have to take it from his Roth if they don't want to.
Yep.
What are your thoughts?
Totally agree. I think they're worried about something that probably isn't an issue, and they just are not envisioning the reality of distribution order from a Roth being mandatory or mandated by law, by rule from the IRS, in that contributions come out first, then conversions, and then finally any growth that may have occurred.
Exactly. Just remember to file 8606, listener. Mm-hmm. If you're using a tax preparer, I would hope they do that. If you're using a program, any of the tax programs, it should automatically do that as well. If you're doing it yourself and you're doing it by hand, make sure you file Form 8606. That's how you are going to track the distributions from your Roth, and that's how the IRS is going to track the earnings that are coming out first. Okay, so we just wanted to point that out. Mm-hmm. All righty. Next question, which isn't really a question. Someone just wanted us to mention something on his suggestion regarding long-term care insurance. I thought it was a good thing to mention, so I want to pass that on. He says, hi, I listened to your comments about LTC insurance, and I agree it's smart to get it as soon as you can in your 50s. Like you, my wife had a stroke. And like you, with no lasting issues, so good news, listener. I was happy to hear that. And for those who don't know, if you're a new listener, go back to December, the end of December. I have a show talking about a stroke I had. But I did suffer a stroke, and I shared with all listeners openly my stroke and tried to encourage people not to do what I was doing in my retirement plan, which as a single person, I felt there was going to be a need for me to have some LTC protection because I have no kids or wife to take care of me or to help take care of me. And I felt I would have to pay for it. And Chris, what was I planning on doing?
Waiting till 60.
Waiting to 60, because that's just kind of the industry standard. You just wait till you turn into your 60s and then you buy the LTC insurance. That was always my goal. But as luck would have it, I ended up having AFib, suffered a very significant stroke, and will most likely not be insurable. However, if my operation this Tuesday works and I can go 3 years without going into AFib once in that 3-year period, insurance companies will at least, Chris, give me the ability to apply, and they might consider my case, which I take as you're still out of luck, but we'll let you apply just the same. I really think my stroke is going to do me in on that. But anyways, his wife is okay. At 15, oh, so where did I leave off? Like you, my wife had a stroke, no lasting issues, when she was 59. And that has disqualified her from any LTC. We did, however, eventually end up with a hybrid policy. I have had my policy since I was 58, and I am now 70. So he's had his policy for a very long time. I'm under the impression his wife, I can't quite understand it. It disqualified her from any LTC, but we ended up with a hybrid policy. If it is a true hybrid LTC policy, she did eventually get coverage from, I'm guessing, he doesn't really specify if she has it. He clearly said he has it. It sounds like she has it, but I'm just reading the words he wrote. Mm-hmm. But then he goes on. You really need to read on your show the lengthy list of conditions that insurance companies use to refuse coverage to people. That, I think, will wake your listeners up. The insurance companies tell people how most are likely to need long-term care insurance, but what they don't tell people is that they are going to cherry pick only those who, in their opinion, are healthy enough to insure yet deny those most likely to need it. I do want to pause there, listeners. What he's describing is what insurance is all about. Don't confuse LTC insurance with what Obamacare did to health insurance when they removed the pre-existing condition requirement and mandated everybody buys it and is eligible and has to be covered and charged the same. That is not an economically viable business model for insurance. That is a politically motivated rule or regulation for buying health insurance. Long-term care insurance is not health insurance. It is regular insurance. It is no different than a auto insurer refusing to insure someone who's been in six accidents over the past 3 years. They're going to say, hey, we're not covering you. You're an anomaly. You're not part of the masses. So they are going to do underwriting. It's no different than a life insurance company saying, we're not going to cover you. You have a shorter than average life expectancy. It's going to be impossible for us to mitigate that risk. You're not in a large enough insurable pool, and we're going to deny coverage. Insurance companies are not mandated to insure every person for every catastrophe. They are only going to insure the average pool, the average people, where they can use the law of large numbers and they can use their actuarial tables to kind of guess about how many people in that pool are going to need coverage. If they covered everyone and everybody knew they could get coverage, I wouldn't have bought LTC until I was absolutely ready I would need it.
Right.
Which, of course, I didn't know I was going to have a stroke. But you would hold off and say, oh, no big deal. I'll get it if something happens. You can't do it that way. Anything you want to add before I get to the meat of his point?
No, I think that covered the essence of how they underwrite and price insurance.
Okay. So he did say or send a list of items that he found were causing people to be denied, and he asked me to read it. So I am going to read through this list. What the listener is trying to do is get you to understand, which is what Chris and I were trying to do after my stroke, to get you listeners to understand. If you want to protect yourself and add long-term care insurance as part of your retirement repertoire, if you will. And I know a lot of people listening to this show, you're do-it-yourselfer Vanguardians, and you despise insurance because you were taught to despise insurance, and you're going to, quote-unquote, self-insure, which we tell you is really self-fund. You have to look, even if you have millions in assets, 2-3 million in assets, you have to look if you're going to be spending money on minimum dignity floor needs, if you want to ensure a guaranteed inheritance, if you want to put a buffer aside, if you're going to want some emergency reserve in the future, if you want to spend on fun, especially during your go-go phase, and get out there and spend like drunk sailors on shore leave and enjoy the things you want to do, there may not be enough money to cover all those expenses and to put $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 aside to self-insure. So you really got to crunch the numbers. But if you want long-term care insurance or want to consider leveraging some, self-insure some, leverage some with insurance, it's not an all or nothing. Here are some other reasons besides AFib and a stroke like I had. Here are some other things he wanted us to point out. The first, you've had a stroke. Duh, that's what I just talked about. Diabetes, back pain, arthritis. Now, in arthritis, it's rheumatoid arthritis and other forms of arthritis like that. My sister has rheumatoid arthritis. She will never get long-term care insurance.
And some might say, what's the back pain thing all about? Well, two of the six activities of daily living trigger have to do, you know, losing the ability to do two of six. And of those six, many of them are mobility related. So if the back pain progresses to the point where it makes it so you can't get in and out of bed on your own and get in and out of a chair on your own and transfer to the toilet on your own, that's what they're worried about with the back pain.
Exactly. Possible psychiatric illnesses, memory problems. Now, that's a no-brainer. If you do have
no
short-term...
No pun intended.
Pardon?
No pun intended. That was a beautiful pun. You have no. You punned yourself there.
Memory issues?
That's a no-brainer?
Oh, hey, that was pretty good.
That was pretty good. I'm trying to give you credit for something you didn't even intend.
I didn't even know I said it. I just was on one of my rolls where I'm not thinking of what I'm saying.
Anyway,
that's what my brain's
thinking.
See,
there's proof right there. There's proof to everyone. I do listen carefully to everything that Jim
says. I say, well, that was a pretty good. I like that. Do we have, what do you call that? One of those, what do you call those?
Rim shot. And no, I do not have one of those.
No, that was a rim shot category.
That event is so rare on the show that... I haven't programmed the rim shot into the sound effects.
True. It's so rare that I say something that needs a rim shot. Memory problems. That's a no-brainer, folks, especially if you are over the age. I believe it's 60, but it might be 65. There's a certain age during the application process where they will actually give you a memory test. They actually hold a phone interview. I have warned people repeatedly on that. True story. We had two people years ago trying to get long-term care insurance, Chris. The wife was very serious about it. The husband did not take it seriously. He did not feel there was a need for insurance. Everyone else was going to need it, not him. And during the memory test, he decided to joke, quote unquote, joke with the people, and he purposefully muffed it. And he was denied insurance. He tried to get them to understand. He had purposefully muffed it. His wife was irate. But he was denied coverage. And it goes into his MIB file. And everyone, all insurance companies know that he muffed it. I have no idea what ended up happening with that and if they appealed it and tried to get into underwriting with another company to prove he was okay. But it did cause quite the problem. Initially with that couple in that situation. So memory problems, again, folks, they will definitely go because if you are going to have short-term memory issues, you could be exposed to dementia, Alzheimer's, and they're just not going to cover you. Have had or currently have cancer, and that is true. Now, that said, if you go certain number of years, similar to me with my AFib, certain number of years with out reoccurrence from the date of last treatment, not from the date you got cancer. So they're going to make you do, if it takes 1, 2, 3 years of treatment, that's when they start measuring. And you have to go, depending on your cancer type, a certain number of years from that point. Then you can just apply. It doesn't mean you're going to get it. It means they'll allow you to apply and they will consider you. The risk that this exposes you to, Chris, is during this very lengthy time period, such as the period I'm in, I'm not even going to be eligible until beginning Tuesday, the day after my procedure. And then I have to go a certain number of years without one episode of AFib. If I have an episode, I'm not going to get it. So it can take a very long time. Were or currently are a smoker, I'm not going to say that's necessarily going to keep you from getting coverage, but it might expose you to other conditions that would make getting coverage difficult, if not impossible. Have needed in the past long-term care assistance. That is true, folks, but very few people go in and out of needing long-term care. Now, that's not to say if you needed help for 2 or 3 weeks after an operation, they would deny you, but they would look at that. But if you truly couldn't complete 2 of 6 activities of daily living and then miraculously overcame that, chances are you are not going to be able to get long-term care. If you are obese or extremely underweight, that is true. And a lot of people don't realize that. We had one person denied coverage, Chris, because they were extremely underweight. And I don't know the rationale behind that, but I'm sure the underwriters had a reason or felt that it could expose them to something. Anyways, I'm going to pause there. I just wanted to give you some of what that gentleman suggested we talk about. But the point is, folks, as this listener said, if you are interested in building LTC into your retirement plan, and you can still self-fund some of it, but you might want to self-fund some and insure some. It can actually cost you less money than fully self-funding, in the sense when you fully self-fund, and we're going to do a whole EDU show on this in the not too distant future. When you fully self-fund and you're going to dedicate $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 of your assets, after you've divvied up all your monies to minimum dignity floor, to long-term care, aging assistance, as we call it, to maybe a guaranteed inheritance and a buffer, there may not be enough money, Chris, for that crucial go-go phase of fund spending. And you start to realize, goodness, this is what makes retirement planning so difficult. Money that I put aside to take care of the older me reduces what the younger me can spend. And if we spend it all during the younger years, which is what I want to do during my go-go fund spending, it might expose the older me to unnecessary financial burden. And where do you, Chris, come up with that happy medium? That's what a sound retirement plan will do. And what this listener is saying, as you're waiting to figure all this out, you might suffer any number of conditions that'll keep you from ever getting coverage. Any thoughts?
Nope. You've kind of summarized the topics that we kind of touch on for long-term care regularly, so...
Perfect. I got two more I hope to get to if we can.
Two more what?
One. Two more questions if we can.
Oh, no, we can't. We're done.
Yeah?
Yes, we are. Sorry.
All right. Sorry to the Virginian and the South Carolinian.
Well, they wouldn't have known unless you've said that.
Chris just shot you down. Apparently, he don't like the South because he just shot you down.
Well, we have a finite time period here on Fridays, so... All right,
folks. Well, I do appreciate everybody listening to this episode of the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. I'll let Chris wrap everything up, but I will tell everybody next week. Actually, if I'm not on next week's show, please send flowers to.
and I'll give an explanation.
And send your condolences to my mom. All jokes aside, hopefully that will not happen, and I will be on next week's show telling everyone how I made out.
We look forward to it.
I'm sure.
And if you end up being awake during it, you can give us the blow by blow.
I am not going to be awake, dude. No way. There's just no way in hell. I'll knock myself out. I mean, if they don't want to do it, I'll just reach over, grab whatever it is the anesthesiologist has, and take a deep breath. Do they do it with gas, or do they do it with an injection? I should have asked the anesthesiologist.
It's kind of a combination. They usually give you some stuff, and then they also, I mean, I'm not an anesthesiologist. I've just experienced it with, I have a large family, and several have had some medical issues. So I've been a sideline participant, I guess, in a lot of those things. So they usually get you relaxed before you go in with kind of a little pre-dose when you're in the pre-op area, and you're kind of loopy as you go in there, nice and relaxed, but you're still awake because they might need you to move around a little bit. Then when you're all settled in the operating room, they give you the gas and put you the rest of the way.
Oh, so it is gas?
I think they're probably going to give you some of the gas at the end. But sometimes I think they can do it all through the IV. So I think it depends on the procedure and the preference of the anesthesiologist and how they've determined is best to keep you under. So, but you're definitely going to get poked.
Yeah, I know they're going to poke.
You're
going to
get the IV.
That's
you can't talk them out of that. That's pretty much.
Well, I know that. Again, the thrombectomy, the brain surgery they did to save me during my stroke was probably worse than this. Very similar procedure where they went in through an artery, but now they're going to go in through it. No, they went in through a vein, and now they're going to go in through an artery. But the stroke, I didn't have time to think.
You didn't have two weeks to think about it. Yeah,
it's just the stroke. It's that they're telling you, if you don't do this, you're going to die. Do you want to do it?
Yes,
I mean,
yes,
what are your choice?
Yes, right.
But this, I've just been constantly thinking about it for 3 weeks. So I'm anxious to get it done.
Perfect.
All right, folks. Anyways, we'll give you all an update. Chris is going to wrap this up on how to reach us if you get your own questions or if you'd like to consider becoming a client of ours. And again, thanks everyone who sent me good well wishes, and I'll let you all know how I make out.
Okay. Good luck on Monday if I don't talk to you before that.
All right. Thanks.
Okay, sure. Well, thanks everybody for sticking with us through another Q&A show. If you'd like to send in your own questions for us to answer, best way to do that is go to the website, jimhelps.com. That's jimhelps.com. Or you can email Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. And we'll get you in the queue of questions. We were out of Social Security questions for a while, so we hopped on a few. We've got a small pool of those now, but as long as they're retirement-related questions, we're interested in hearing about just anything that you want to ask about. And if it's something that we really just aren't that knowledgeable about, we'll either get an expert on here, or we might put off answering your question again for a while. But some of the more bizarre questions are most interesting at this point. We've been doing this podcast for a long time, so we love when we get some interesting, somewhat complicated question that comes in. So don't hesitate. If you think you have something that's kind of oddball, we'd love to hear it, honestly. But just go to that website if you want to learn more about us, jimhelps.com. You can submit a question if you have one, but you can also learn about us, what we do. And if you're interested in what we are able to provide to people as far as financial planning advice, you can reach out on that website and we can connect with you and see if there's something we can help you out with. So we really appreciate you listening, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.